The hammer stopped halfway across the room. Mr. White walked over and picked it out of the air. "Really, your ladyship," he said. "You think we don't watch you? You, the Igor, make the clock ready." Igor looked from him to Lady Lejean and back. "I only take orders from Martha Jeremy, thank you," he said.
"The world will end if you start that clock," said Lady Lejean.
"What a foolish idea," said Mr. White. "We laugh at it." "Ha, ha, ha," said the other auditors obediently.
"I don't need medicine," Jeremy shouted, pushing Dr. Hopkins out of the way. "And I don't need people to tell me what to do. Shut up!"
In the silence, thunder grumbled in the clouds.
"Thank you," said Jeremy more calmly. "Now, I hope I am a rational man, and I shall approach this rationally. A clock is a measuring device. I have built the perfect clock, my lady. I mean, ladies and gentlemen. It will revolutionize timekeeping." He reached up and moved the hands of the clock to almost 1 o'clock. Then he reached down, gripped the pendulum, and set it swinging. The world continued to exist. "You see, the universe doesn't stop, even for my clock," Jeremy went on.
He folded his hands and sat down.
"Watch,"
he said calmly. The clock ticked gently. Then something rattled in the machinery around it, and the big green glass tubes of acid began to sizzle.
"Well, nothing seems to have happened," said Dr. Hopkins. "That's a blessing."
Sparks crackled around the lightning rod positioned above the clock.
"This is just making a path for the lightning," said Jeremy happily. "We send a little lightning up, and a lot more comes back."
Things were moving inside the clock. There was a sound best represented as fizzle, and greenish-blue light filled the case.
"Ah, the cascade has initialized," said Jeremy. "As a little exercise, the, more traditional pendulum clock has been slaved to the big clock, you'll see, so that every second it will be readjusted to the correct time."
He smiled, and one cheek twitched.
"Some day all clocks will be like this," he said, and added, "While I normally hate such an imprecise term as any second now, nevertheless I—" Tick!
There was a fight going on in the square, in the strange colours involved in the time-slicing state known as Zimmerman's Valley. It was picked out in shades of light blue. By the look of it, a couple of watchmen were trying to take on a gang. One man was airborne and hung there without support. Another had fired a crossbow directly at one of the watchmen. The arrow was nailed, unmoving in the air. Lobsang examined it curiously.
"You're going to touch it, aren't you?" said a voice behind Lobsang. "You're just going to reach out and touch it, despite everything I've told you. Pay attention to the damn sky."
Lutze was smoking nervously. When it got a few inches away from his body, the smoke went rigid in the air.
"Are you sure you can't feel where it is?" he snapped.
"It's all round us, Sweeper. We're so close, it's like trying to see the wood when you're standing under the trees. Well, this is the street of cunning artificers, and that's the guild of clockmakers over there," said Lutze. "And I don't dare go inside if it's this close, not until we're certain.
What about the university?
Wizards aren't mad enough to try it."
"You're going to try and race the lightning?"
"It's doable. If we start from here in the valley, lightning ain't as quick as people think."
"Are we waiting to see a little pointy bit of lightning coming out of the cloud?"
"Ha! Kids today, where do they get their education? The first stroke is from the ground to the air, lad. That makes a nice hole in the air for the main lightning to come down. Look for the glow. We've got to be giving the road plenty of sandal by the time it reaches the clouds. You holding up okay?"
"I could go on like this all day," said Lobsang.
"Don't try it."
Lutze scanned the sky again.
"Maybe I was wrong. Maybe it's just a storm. Sooner or later you get—"
He stopped. One look at Lobsang's face was enough.
"Okay," said the sweeper slowly. "Just give me the direction. Point if you can't speak."
Lobsang dropped to his knees, hands rising to his head.
"I don't know. Don't know."
Silvery lights rose over the city a few streets away. Lutze grabbed the boy's elbow.
"Come on, lad, on your feet. Faster than lightning, eh? Okay?"
Yeah, okay.
You can do it, right?"
Lobsang blinked. He could see the glass house again, stretching away as a pale outline overlaid on the city.
"Clock!" he said thickly. "Run, boy, run!" shouted Lutze. "And don't stop for anything!"
Lobsang plunged forward and found it hard. Time moved aside for him, sluggishly at first, as his legs pumped. With every step he pushed himself, faster and faster, the landscape changing colours again as the world slowed even further. There was another stitch in time, the sweeper had said, another valley, even closer to the null point. Insofar as he could think at all, Lobsang hoped he would reach it soon. His body felt as though it would fly apart. He could feel his bones creaking. The glow ahead was halfway to the iron-heavy clouds now, but he'd reached a crossroads and he could see it rising from a house halfway down the street. He turned to look for the sweeper and saw the man yards behind him, mouth open, a statue falling forward. Lobsang turned, concentrated, let time speed up. He reached Lutze and caught him before he hit the ground. There was blood coming from the old man's ears.
"I can't do it, lad," the sweeper mumbled. "Get on, get on!"
"I can do it. It's like running downhill.
Not for me, it ain't."
"I can't just leave you here like this.
Save us from heroes. Get that bloody clock!"
Lobsang hesitated. The downstroke was already emerging from the clouds, a drifting, glowing spike. He ran. The lightning was falling towards a shop a few buildings away. He could see a big clock hanging over its window. He pushed against the flow of time ever further, and it yielded, but the lightning had reached the iron pole atop the building. The window was closer than the door. He lowered his head and jumped through it, the glass shattering around him and then freezing in midair, clocks pinwheeling off the display and stopping as if caught in invisible amber. There was another door ahead of him. He grabbed the knob and pulled, feeling the terrible resistance of a slab of wood urged to move an appreciable fraction of the speed of light. It was barely open a few inches when he saw, beyond, the slow ooze of lightning run down the rod and into the heart of the big clock. The clock struck one. Time stopped. Tick. Mr. Soak, the dairyman, was washing bottles at the sink when the air dimmed and the water solidified. He stared at it for a moment, and then, with the manner of a man trying an experiment, held the bottle over the stone floor and let it go. It remained hanging in the air.
"Damn it," he said. "Another idiot with a clock, eh?"
What he did then was not usual dairy practice. He walked into the centre of the room and made a few passes in the air with his hands. The air brightened. The water splashed. The bottle smashed, although, when Ronnie turned around and waved a hand at it, the glass slivers ran together again. Then Ronnie Soak sighed and went to the cream-settling room. Large, wide bowls stretched away into the distance, and if Ronnie had ever allowed another to notice this, the distance contained far more distance than is ever found in a normal building.
"Show me," he said.
The surface of the nearest bowl of milk became a mirror, and then began to show pictures. Ronnie went back into the dairy, took his peaked cap off its hook by the door, and crossed the courtyard to the stable. The sky overhead was a sullen, unmoving grey as he emerged, leading his horse. The horse was black, glistening with condition, and there was this about it that was odd. It shone as though it was illuminated by a red light. Redness spangled off its shoulders and flanks, even under the greyness. And even when it was harnessed to the cart, it didn't look like any kind of horse that should be hitched to any kind of wagon. But people never noticed this, and again, Ronnie took care to make sure that they didn't. The cart gleamed with white paint, picked out here and there with a fresh green. The wording on the side declared proudly, "Ronald Soak, Hygienic Dairyman, Established." Perhaps it was odd that people never said, "Established when, exactly?" If they ever had, the answer would have had to be quite complicated. Ronnie opened the gates to the yard, and milk crates rattling set out into the timeless moment. It was terrible, he thought, the way things conspired against the small businessman. Lobsang Lud awoke to a little clicking, spinning sound. He was in darkness, but it yielded reluctantly to his hand. It felt like velvet, and it was. He'd rolled under one of the display cabinets. There was a vibration in the small of his back. He reached around gingerly and realized that the portable procrastinator was revolving in its cage.
So, how did it go now?
He was living on borrowed time. He'd got maybe an hour, perhaps a lot less, but he could slice it, so... No. Something told him that trying that would be a really terminal idea, with time stored in a device made by Q. The mere thought made him feel that his skin was inches from a universe full of razor blades. So, 1 hour, perhaps a lot less. But you could rewind a spinner, right? No. The handle was at the back. You could rewind someone else's spinner. Thank you, Q, and your experimental models. Could you take it off, then?
No.
The harness was part of it. Without it, different parts of your body would be travelling at different speeds. The effect would probably be rather like freezing a human body solid and then pushing it down a flight of stone stairs. Open the box with the crowbar that you will find inside. There was a green-blue glow through the crack in the door. He took a step towards it and heard the spinner suddenly pick up speed. That meant it was shedding more time, and that was bad when you had an hour, perhaps a lot less. He took a step away from the door, and the procrastinator settled back into its routine clicking. So, Lutze was out in the street, and he had a spinner, and that should have cut in automatically too. In this timeless world, he was going to be the only person who could turn a handle. The glass that he had broken in his leap through the window had opened around the hole like a great sparkling flower. He reached out to touch a piece. It moved as though alive, cut his finger, and then dropped towards the ground, stopping only when it fell out of the field around his body. "Don't touch people," Lutze had said. "Don't touch arrows. Don't touch things that were moving. That was the rule. But the glass..." But the glass in normal time had been flying through the air. It'd still have that energy, wouldn't it? He eased himself carefully around the glass and opened the front door of the shop. The wood moved very slowly, fighting against the enormous speed. Lutze was not in the street. But there was something new hovering in the air just a few inches above the ground, right where the old man had been. It had not been there before. Someone with their own portable time had been here and dropped this and had moved on before it reached the ground. It was a small glass jar, coloured blue by temporal effects. Now, how much energy could it have? Lobsang cupped his hand and gingerly brought it underneath and up, and there was a tingle and a sudden feeling of weight as the spinner's field claimed it. Now its true colours came back. The jar was a milky pink, or rather, clear glass that looked pink because of the contents. The paper lid was covered with badly printed pictures of unbelievably flawless strawberries, surrounding some ornate lettering which read, "Ronald Soak Hygienic Dairyman, Strawberry Yogurt, Fresh as the Morning Dew." Soak. He knew the name. The man had delivered milk to the guild. Good fresh milk, too, not the watery, green-tinted stuff the other dairies supplied. Very reliable, everyone said. But, reliable or not, he was just a milkman. All right, just a very good milkman. And if time had stopped, then why... Lobsang looked around desperately. The people and carts that thronged the street were still there. No one had moved. No one could move. But something was running along the gutter. It looked like a rat in a black robe, running along on its hind legs. It looked up at Lobsang, and he saw that it had a skull rather than a head. As skulls went, it was quite a cheerful one. The word squeak manifested itself inside his brain without bothering to go via his ears. Then the rat hopped onto the pavement and scampered down an alley. Lobsang followed it. A moment later, someone behind him grabbed him by the neck. He went to break the lock and realized how much he'd relied on slicing when he was fought. Besides, the person behind him had a very strong grip indeed. "I just want to make sure you don't do anything silly," it said. It was a female voice. "What is this thing on your back?"
"Who are..."
"The protocol in these matters," said the voice, "is that the person with the killer neck grip asks the questions."
It's a procrastinator. It stores time. Who?"
"Oh, dear, there you go again."
"What is your name?"
"Lobsang. Lobsang Ludd. Look, could you wind me up, please? It's urgent."
"Certainly, Lobsang Ludd. You are thoughtless and impulsive and deserve to die a stupid and pointless death."
"What?"
"And you are also rather slow on the uptake. You are referring to this handle?" Yes, I'm running out of time. Now can I ask who you are?
Miss Susan. Hold still.
He heard, behind him, the incredibly welcome sound of the procrastinator's clockwork being rewound. Miss Susan, he said.
That's what most people I know call me. Now I'm going to let you go. I will add that trying anything stupid will be counterproductive. Besides, I'm the only person in the world right now who might be inclined to twiddle your handle again.
The pressure was released. Lobsang turned slowly. Miss Susan was a slightly built young woman, dressed severely all in black. Her hair stood out around her head like an aura, white blonde with one black streak. But the most striking thing about her was everything, Lobsang realized, everything from her expression to the way she stood. Some people fade into the background. Miss Susan faded into the foreground. She stood out. Everything she stood in front of became nothing more than background.
Finished, she said. Seen everything?
Sorry. Have you seen an old man, dressed a bit like me, with one of these on his back?
No. Now it's my turn. Have you got rhythm?
What? Susan rolled her eyes.
All right, do you have music?
Not on me, no. And you certainly haven't got a girl, said Miss Susan.
I saw Old Man Trouble go past a few minutes ago. It'd be a good idea if you don't bump into him, then.
And is he likely to have taken my friend?
I doubt it. And Old Man Trouble is more an it than a he. Anyway, there's far worse than him around right now. Even the bogeymen have gone to ground.
Look, time has stopped, right? Said Lobsang.
Yes.
So how can you be here talking to me?
I'm not what you might call a creature of time, said Miss Susan. I work in it, but I don't have to live there. There are a few of us about.
Like this Old Man Trouble you mentioned?
Right. And the Hogfather, the Tooth Fairy, the Sandman, people like that.
I thought they were mythical.
So?
Susan glanced out of the mouth of the alley again.
And you're not?
I take it you didn't stop the clock, said Miss Susan, looking up and down the street.
No, I was too late. Perhaps I shouldn't have gone back to help Lut Say.
I'm sorry. You were dashing to prevent the end of the world, but you stopped to help some old man. You hero.
Oh, I wouldn't say that I was a...
And then Lobsang stopped. She hadn't said, you hero, in the tone of you star. It had been in the tone in which people say, you idiot.
I see a lot of your sort, Susan went on. Heroes have a very strange grasp of elementary maths, you know. If you'd smashed the clock before it struck, everything would have been fine. Now the world has stopped, and we've been invaded, and we're probably all going to die, just because you stopped to help someone. I mean, very worthy and all that, but very, very human.
She used the word as if she meant it to mean silly.
You mean you need cool, calculating bastards to save the world, do you? Said Lobsang.
The cool calculation does help, I must admit, said Susan.
Now shall we go and look at this clock?
Why?
The damage is done now. If we smash it, it'll only make things worse. Besides, the spinner started to run wild, and I felt...
Cautious? Said Susan.
Good. Caution is sensible. But there's something I want to check.
Lobsang tried to pull himself together. This strange woman had the air of someone who knew exactly what she was doing, who knew exactly what everyone was doing. And besides, what alternative did he have?
Then he remembered the yoghurt pot.
"Does this mean anything?" he said. "I'm certain it was dropped in the street after time stopped." She took the pot and examined it.
"Oh," she said casually. "Ronnie's been around, has he?"
"Ronnie?"
"Oh, we all know Ronnie."
"What's that supposed to mean?"
"Let's just say, if he found your friend, then your friend is going to be okay.
Probably okay.
More okay than he would be if just about anything else found him, at least. Look, this is not a time when you should be worrying about one person. Cold calculation, right?"
She stepped out into the street. Lobsang followed. Susan walked as if she owned the street. She scanned every alley and doorway, but not like a potential victim apprehensive of attackers. It seemed to Lobsang that she was disappointed to find nothing dangerous in the shadows. She reached the shop, stepped inside, and paused for a moment, to regard the floating flower of broken glass in the shop. Her expression suggested that she considered it to be a perfectly normal kind of thing to find, and had seen far more interesting things. Then she walked on and stopped at the inner door. There was still a glow from the crack, but it was dimmer now. "Settling down," she said. "Shouldn't be too bad, but there's two people in here."
"Who?"
"Wait, I'll open the door, and be careful." The door moved very slowly. Lobsang stepped into the workshop after the girl. The spinner began to speed up. The clock glowed in the middle of the floor, painful to look at. But he stared nevertheless.
It's just as I imagined it," he said. "It's the way to..."
"Don't go near it," said Susan. "It's uncertain death, believe me. Do pay attention." Lobsang blinked. The last couple of thoughts didn't seem to have belonged to him.
"What did you say?"
"I said it's uncertain death."
"Is that worse than certain death?"
"Much."
"Watch."
Susan picked up a hammer that was lying on the floor and poked it gently towards the clock. It vibrated in her hand when she brought it closer, and she swore under her breath as it was dragged from her fingers and vanished. Just before it did, there was a brief, contracting ring around the clock that might have been something like a hammer would be if you rolled it very flat and bent it into a circle.
"Have you any idea why that happened?" she said.
"No."
"Nor have I. Now imagine that you were the hammer.
Uncertain death, see?" Lobsang looked at the two frozen people. One was medium-sized and had all the right number of appendages to qualify as a member of the human race, and so therefore probably had to be given the benefit of the doubt. It was staring at the clock. So was the other figure, which was that of a middle-aged, sheep-faced man, still holding a cup of tea and, as far as Lobsang could make out, a biscuit.
"The one who wouldn't win a beauty contest, even if he was the only entrant, is an Igor," said Susan. "The other one is Dr. Hopkins of the Clockmakers Guild here."
"So we know who built the clock, at least," said Lobsang.
"I don't think so. Mr. Hopkins's workshop is several streets away, and he makes novelty watches for a rather strange kind of discerning customer. It's his speciality."
"Then the Igor must have built it?"
"Good grief, no. Igors are professional servants. They never work for themselves."
"You seem to know a lot," said Lobsang, as Susan circled the clock like a wrestler trying to spy out a hold.
"Yes," she said, without turning her head. "I do. The first clock broke. This one's holding. Whoever designed it was a genius."
"An evil genius?"
"It's hard to say. I can't see any signs."
"What kind of signs?"
"Well,
ha 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 ha! Painted on the side would be a definite clue, don't you think?" she said, rolling her eyes.
"I'm in your way, am I?" said Lobsang.
"No, not at all," said Susan, turning her attention to the workbench. "Well, there's nothing here. I suppose he could have set a timer, a sort of alarm clock."
She stopped. She picked up a length of rubber hose pipe that was coiled on a hook by the glass jars and looked hard at it. Then she tossed it into a corner and stared at it as if she'd never seen anything like it before.
"Don't say a word," she said quietly. "They have some very acute senses. Just ease back among those big glass vats behind you and try to look inconspicuous, and do it now."
The last word had odd harmonics to it, and Lobsang felt his legs begin to move almost without his conscious control. The door moved a little, and a man came in. What was strange about the face, Lobsang thought afterwards, was how unmemorable it was. He'd never seen a face so lacking in anything to mention. It had a nose and a mouth and eyes, and they were all quite flawless, but somehow they didn't make up a face. They were just parts that made no proper whole. If they became anything at all, it was the face of a statue, good-looking, but without anything looking out of it. Slowly, like someone who had to think about his muscles, the man turned to look at Lobsang. Lobsang felt himself bunch up to slice time. The spinner groaned a warning on his back.
"That's about enough, I think," said Susan, stepping forwards. The man was spun round, an elbow was jabbed into his stomach, and then the palm of her hand caught him so hard under his chin that he was lifted off the floor and slammed against the wall. As he fell, Susan hit him on the head with a wrench.
"We might as well be going," she said, as if she'd just shuffled some paper that had been untidy. "Nothing more for us here."
"You killed him."
"Certainly. He's not a human being. I have a sense about these things. It's sort of inherited. Besides, go and pick up the hose. Go on."
Since she was still holding the wrench, Lobsang did so.
Or tried.
tried to do so. The coil she'd flung into the corner was knotted and tangled like rubber spaghetti.
"Malignancy, my grandfather calls it," said Susan. "The local hostility of things towards non-things always increases when there's an auditor about. They can't help it. The hosepipe test is very reliable in the field, according to a rat I know."
Rat, thought Lobsang, but he said, "What's an auditor?"
"And they have no sense of colour. They don't understand it. Look how he's dressed. Grey suit, grey shirt, grey shoes, grey cravat, grey everything."
Perhaps it was just someone trying to be very cool."
"You think so?"
"No loss there, then," said Susan.
"Anyway, you're wrong. Watch."
The body was disintegrating. It was a fast and quite ungory process, a sort of dry evaporation. It simply became floating dust which expanded away and vanished. But the last few handfuls formed, just for a few seconds, a familiar shape. That, too, vanished with the merest whisper of a scream.
"That was a Dlang," he said. "An evil spirit. The peasants down in the valleys hang up charms against them, but I thought they were just a superstition."
"No, they're a substition," said Susan. "I mean, they're real, but hardly anyone really believes in them. Mostly everyone believes in things that aren't real. Something very strange is going on. These things are all over the place, and they've got bodies. That's not right. We've got to find the person who built the clock."
"And, what are you, Miss Susan?"
"Me?
I'm a schoolteacher."
She followed his gaze to the wrench that she still held in her hand, and shrugged.
"It can get pretty rough at break time, can it?" said Lobsang.
There was an overpowering smell of milk. Lutse sat bolt upright. It was a large room, and he had been placed on a table in the middle of it. By the feel of the surface, it was sheeted with metal. There were churns stacked along the wall, and big metal bowls ranged beside a sink the size of a bath. Under the milk smell were many others, disinfectant, well-scrubbed wood, and a distant odour of horses. Footsteps approached. Lutse lay back hurriedly and shut his eyes. He heard someone enter the room. They were whistling under their breath, and they had to be a man, because no woman in Lutse's long experience had ever whistled in that warbling, hissing way. The whistling approached the slab, stayed still for a moment, then turned away and headed for the sink. It was replaced by the sound of a pump handle being operated. Lutse half-opened one eye. The man standing at the sink was quite short, so that the standard-issue blue and white-striped apron he wore almost reached the floor. He appeared to be washing bottles. Lutse swung his legs off the slab, moving with a stealthiness that made the average ninja sound like a brass band, and let his sandals gently touch the floor.
"Feeling better?" said the man, without turning his head.
"Oh, yeah, fine," said Lutse. "I thought..." "Here's a little bald monk sort of fellow," said the figure, holding a bottle up to the light to inspect it, "with a wind-up thing on his back, and down on his luck. Fancy a cup of tea? Kettle's on, I've got yak butter."
"Yak, am I still in Ankh-Morpork?"
Lutse looked down at a rack of ladles beside him. The man still hadn't looked round.
"Ah, interesting question," said the bottle washer. "You could say you're sort of in Ankh-Morpork. No to yak milk? I can get cow's milk or goat, sheep, camel, llama, horse, cat, dog, dolphin, whale, or alligator, if you prefer."
"What, alligators don't give milk?"
said Lutse, grasping the biggest ladle. It made no noise as it came off its hook.
"I didn't say it was easy."
The sweeper got a good grip.
"What is this place, friend?" he said. "You are in the dairy."
The figure at the sink said the last word as if it was as portentous as Castle of Dread. Placed another bottle on the draining board, and, still with his back to Lutse, held up a hand. All the fingers were folded, except for the middle digit, which was extended.
"You know what this is, monk?" he said. "It's not a friendly gesture, friend."
The ladle felt good and heavy. Lutse had used much worse weapons than this.
"Oh, a superficial interpretation. You are an old man, monk. I can see the centuries on you. Tell me what this is, and know what I am."
The coldness in the dairy got a little colder.
"It's your middle finger," said Lutse.
"Pah!"
said the figure.
"Pah?"
"Yes, pah! You have a brain, use it."
"Look, it was good of you to...
You know the secret wisdoms that everyone seeks, monk."
The bottle washer paused.
"No, I even suspect that you know the explicit wisdoms, the ones hidden in plain view, which practically no one looks for. Who am I?"
Lutse stared at the solitary finger.
The walls of the dairy faded, the cold grew deeper. His mind raced, and the librarian of memory took over. This wasn't a normal place. That wasn't a normal man. A finger, one finger, one of the five digits on a... One of five. One of five. Faint echoes of an ancient legend signalled his attention. One from five is four, and one left over. Lutse very carefully hung the ladle back on its hook.
One from five, he said. The fifth of four. There we are. I could see you were educated. You were the one who left before they became famous.
Yep.
But this is a dairy and you're washing bottles.
Well, I had to do something with me time.
But you were the fifth horseman of the apocalypse.
And I bet you can't remember my name.
Lutse hesitated.
No, he said. I don't think I ever heard it.
The fifth horseman turned round. His eyes were black. Completely black. Shiny and black and without any whites at all.
My name, said the fifth horseman, is...
Yes?
My name is Ronnie.
Timelessness grew like ice. Waves froze on the sea. Birds were pinned to the air. The world went still. But not quiet. There was a sound like a finger running around the rim of a very large glass.
"Come on," said Susan. "Can't you hear it?" said Lobsang, stopping. "But it's no use to us."
She pushed Lobsang back into the shadows. The robed grey shape of an auditor appeared in the air halfway down the street and began to spin. The air around it filled with dust, which became a whirling cylinder, which became slightly unsteady on its feet, something that looked human. It rocked backwards and forwards for a moment. It raised its hands slowly and looked at them, turning them this way and that. Then it marched away purposefully. Further along the street, it was joined by another one, emerging from an alley.
"This really isn't like them," said Susan, as the pair turned a corner. "They're up to something. Let's follow them."
"What about Lutse?"
"What about him? How old did you say he was?"
"He says he's 800 years old."
"Hard to kill, then. Ron is safe enough if you're alert and don't argue. Come on."
She set off along the streets. The auditors were joined by others, weaving between the silent carts and motionless people and along the streets towards, as it turned out, Sator Square, one of the biggest open spaces in the city. It was market day. Silent, motionless figures thronged the stalls, but amongst them there were scurrying grey shapes.
"There's hundreds of them," said Susan, "all human-shaped, and it looks like they're having a meeting."
Mr. White was losing patience. Until now he had never been aware that he had any, because, if anything, he had been all patience. But now he could feel it evaporating. It was a strange, hot sensation in his head. How could a thought be hot? The mass of incarnated auditors watched him nervously.
"I am Mr. White," he said to the luckless new auditor that had been brought before him, and shuddered with the astonishment of using that singular word and surviving.
"You cannot be Mr. White also. It would be a matter of confusion."
"But we are running out of colours," said Mr. Violet, intervening.
"That cannot be the case," said Mr. White. "There is an infinite number of colours."
"But there are not that many names," said Miss Tope.
"That is not possible. A colour must have a name."
"We can find only 103 names for green before the colour becomes noticeably either blue or yellow," said Miss Crimson.
"But the shades are endless."
"Nevertheless, the names are not."
"This is a problem that must be solved. Add it to the list, Miss Brown. We must name every possible shade."
One of the female auditors looked startled.
"I cannot remember all the things," she said, "nor do I understand why you are giving orders."
"Apart from the renegade, I have the greatest seniority as an incarnate."
"Only by a matter of seconds," said Miss Brown.
"That is immaterial. Seniority is seniority. That is a fact."
It was a fact.
auditors respected facts. And it was also a fact, Mr. White knew, that there were now more than 700 auditors walking rather awkwardly around the city. Mr. White had put a stop to the relentless increase in incarnations as more and more of his fellows rushed into the trouble spot. It was too dangerous. The renegade had demonstrated, he pointed out, that the human shape forced the mind to think in a certain troublesome way. The utmost caution was necessary. This was a fact. Only those with a proven ability to survive the process should be allowed to incarnate and complete the work. This was a fact. Auditors respected facts, at least until now. Miss Brown took a step back.
"Nevertheless," she said, "being here is dangerous. It is my view that we should discarnate."
Mr. White found his body replying by itself. It let out a breath of air.
"And leave things unknown," he said. "Things that are unknown are dangerous. We are learning much."
"What we are learning makes no sense," said Miss Brown.
"The more we learn, the more sense it will make. There is nothing we cannot understand," said Mr. White.
"I do not understand why it is that I now perceive a desire to bring my hand in sharp contact with your face," said Miss Brown.
"Exactly my point," said Mr. White. "You do not understand it, and therefore it is dangerous. Perform the act, and we will know more." She hit him.
He raised his hand to his cheek.
"Unbidden thoughts of avoidance of repetition are engendered," he said. "Also heat. Remarkably, the body does indeed appear to do some thinking on its own behalf."
"For my part," said Miss Brown, "the unbidden thoughts are of satisfaction coupled with apprehension."
"Already we learn more about humans," said Mr. White.
"To what end?" said Miss Brown,
whose sensations of apprehension were increasing at the sight of the contorted expression on Mr. White's face.
"For our purposes they are no longer a factor. Time has ended. They are fossils. The skin under one of your eyes is twitching."
"You are guilty of inappropriate thought," said Mr. White. "They exist. Therefore we must study them in every detail. I wish to try a further experiment. My eye is functioning perfectly."
He took an axe from a market stall. Miss Brown took another step back.
"Unbidden thoughts of apprehension increase markedly," she said.
"Yet this is a mere lump of metal on a piece of wood," said Mr. White, hefting the axe. "We, who have seen the hearts of stars, we who have watched worlds burn, we who have seen space tormented, what is there about this axe that could cause concern to us?"
He swung. It was a clumsy blow, and the human neck is a lot tougher than people believe, but Miss Brown's neck exploded into coloured motes, and she collapsed. Mr. White looked around at the nearest auditors, who all stepped back.
"Is there anyone else who wishes to try the experiment?" he said.
There was a chorus of hasty refusals.
"Good," said Mr. White. "Already we are learning a great deal."
"He chopped her head off."
"Don't shout and keep your head down," Susan hissed.
"But he, I think she knows. Anyway, it's an it, and so's it."
"What's going on?"
Susan drew back into the shadows.
"I'm not entirely sure," she said, "but I think they've tried to make themselves human bodies. Pretty good copies, too, and now they're acting human."
"Do you call that acting human?"
Susan gave Lobsang a sad look.
"You don't get out much, do you?"
"My grandfather says that if an intelligent creature takes a human shape, it starts to think human. Form defines function."
"That was the action of an intelligent creature," said Lobsang, still shocked.
"Not only doesn't get out much, but also doesn't read history," said Susan glumly.
"Do you know about the curse of the werewolves?"
Isn't being a werewolf curse enough?
They don't think so. But if they stay wolf-shaped for too long, they stay a wolf, said Susan. A wolf is a very strong form, you see. Even though the mind is human, the wolf creeps in through the nose and the ears and the paws. Know about witches?
We stole the broomstick of one of them to get here, said Lobsang.
Really? Bit of luck for you that the world's ended, then, said Susan. Anyway, some of the best witches have this trick they call borrowing. They can get into the mind of an animal. Very useful. But the trick is to know when to pull out. Be a duck for too long, and a duck you'll stay. A bright duck, maybe, with some odd memories, but still a duck. The poet Ho-Ha once dreamed he was a butterfly, and then he awoke and said, "Am I a man who dreamed he was a butterfly, or am I a butterfly dreaming he is a man?" said Lobsang, trying to join in.
"Really?" said Susan briskly. "And which was he?"
"What? Well, who knows?"
"How did he write his poems?" said Susan.
"With a brush, of course.
He didn't flap around making information-rich patterns in the air or laying eggs on cabbage leaves?"
"No one ever mentioned it."
"Then he was probably a man," said Susan.
"Interesting, but it doesn't move us on a lot. Except you could say that the others are dreaming that they're human and the dream is real, and they've got no imagination. Just like my grandfather, really. They can create a perfect copy of anything, but they can't make anything that's new. So what I think is happening is that they're finding out what being human really means."
"Which is?"
"That you're not as much in control as you think."
She took another careful look at the crowd in the square.
"Do you know anything about the person who built the clock?"
"Me? No, well, not really."
"Then how did you find the place?"
"Lutse thought this was where the clock was being built."
"Really?
Not a bad guess. You even got the right house."
It was me that found the house. I knew that was where I should be. Does that sound silly?"
"Oh, yes, with twinkly bells and bluebirds on it. But it might be true. I always know where I should be, too.
And where should you be now?"
"Just a minute," said Lobsang.
"Who are you?"
"Time has stopped. The world is given over to fairy tales and monsters, and there's a school teacher walking around."
"Best kind of person to have," said Susan. "We don't like silliness. Anyway, I told you, I've inherited certain talents."
"Like living outside time?"
"That's one of them."
"It's a weird talent for a school teacher."
"Good for marking, though," said Susan calmly.
"Are you actually human?"
"Ha! As human as you are. I won't say I haven't got a few skeletons in the family closet, though."
There was something about the way she said it.
"That wasn't just a figure of speech, was it?" said Lobsang flatly.
"No, not really," said Susan.
"That thing on your back, what happens when it stops spinning?"
"I'll run out of time, of course."
"Ah. So the fact that it slowed down and stopped back there when that auditor practiced its axemanship isn't a factor, then?"
"It's not turning."
Panicking, Lobsang tried to reach around to the small of his back, spinning himself in the effort.
"It looks as though you have a hidden talent," said Susan, leaning against the wall and grinning.
"Please, wind me up again."
"All right, you are a—"
"That wasn't very funny the first time."
"That's all right. I don't have much of a sense of humour."
She grabbed his arms as he wrestled with the straps of the spinner.
"You don't need it, understand," she said. "It's just a dead weight. Trust me, don't give in. You're making your own time. Don't wonder how."
He stared at her in terror.
"What's happening?"
"It's okay, it's okay," said Susan as patiently as she could. "This sort of thing always comes as a shock. When it happened to me, there wasn't anyone around, so consider yourself lucky."
"What happened to you?"
"I found out who my grandfather was. And don't ask. Now, concentrate. Where ought you to be?"
Lobsang looked around.
"Over that way, I think."
"I wouldn't dream of asking."
"Oh," said Susan. "And it's away from that mob." She smiled.
"Look on the bright side," she added.
"We're young. We've got all the time in the world." She swung the wrench onto her shoulder.
"Let's go clubbing."